Welcome to Hollywood Ungagged, the New Zealand tomato soup of political podcasts. Season 5, Episode 2, I am your host, David McClemon, broadcasting from the Blantyre Free State. Joining me this evening is the co-convener of SNP Socialists, a Republican with a small R, and co-host of the Ungagged Talking Sense podcast, it's Kat Carey. Hi Kat, I think you'll be in a good mood today, I'm sensing.
Yes, I am.
Good, good.
Hello.
And the third member of this evening's triumvirate is Holyrood OG, the Woodfire Dare, Falkirk's Pizza Hut Prince himself, Brian Stewart Finlay. Hello.
Hello, hello.
So how are you doing today? How was your weekend?
Go on, Kat.
I was kind of just, I was a little bit ill, so that was fine. Like I said last week, I took a choice to be optimistic, so I didn't let the leadership contest weigh too heavily on me and spend time with my family.
It's a strange thing, because I think almost everybody had probably voted before the last few days. So you felt as if they could have just announced it rather than have this few days where everybody was just kind of going through the motions and it probably was there was no more votes left to be won.
I did see someone tweet out that they, at the last minute, decided to vote for Kate. Wow, that's definitely a look, you know, announcing it to the world. Yeah.
How was your weekend, Brian?
It was good. Done lots of nice bits and pieces with the family. Seen Glenn. We went to see Fern Brady last night.
All right.
That was good.
Was that at the Kings in Glasgow?
It was, yeah. Had a really, really good evening. Had some nice dinner, got some good comedy. And really nice general, nice weekend. Spent the whole day today pretty much ignoring the media hype and build up to the announcement of the leadership candidate. I went swimming as well today, which was quite nice. Spent some time with pals, went for walking in the sunshine. It was very nice.
So it's a very productive weekend. Well done, Brian.
Thank you.
I was working all weekend, so I was, well, I suppose technically it's productive, but it didn't feel very productive. Night shift all weekend, which meant I was either sleeping or at work. And that means I've actually not had any sleep for about 30 hours now, so we'll see how that goes.
Slap anyway, happy and fancy free.
I think we're all desperate to get into the first topic here, so I think we should just get on gag.
This is a song for the heavy-hearted, lost friends and the
Okay, there is a new SNP leader. Humza Yousaf is to succeed Nicola Sturgeon as SNP leader and will become Scotland's first minister after a vote of party members. Mr. Yousaf defeated rivals Kate Forbes and Ash Regan in a leadership contest that exposed deep divisions within the party. The 37-year-old, oh my God, he's younger than me, is the first Muslim to lead a major UK party. He is set to be confirmed as the first ethnic minority leader of a devolved government on Tuesday. The leadership election was decided by a single transferable vote system, with 50,490 of the SNP's 72,000 members casting a ballot. He did not win in the majority of the first round of voting, but won 52.1% of the vote after the second preference votes from Miss Regan, who was eliminated after finishing third. Kate Forbes came second with 47.9% of the vote when second preferences were included, with Mr. Yousaf receiving 26,032 votes and Miss Forbes 23,890. As the SNP member in the room, Kat, I think we'll go to you first. You're a big supporter of Humza from the start, so I'm guessing you're delighted with this.
I am delighted and very, very relieved. Too close for comfort, in my opinion, but a win's a win, and I'm so happy. I mean, if you take the absolute reverse of all the Ash Regan photos today, that's pretty much my face right now, and has been since about 2 p.m.
Brian?
Yeah, I was just really relieved. I think that's the main feeling that I felt. It was like, you know, just taking a big long exhale after everything that's been going on, you know, for the past kind of 5 weeks or so, because it's been a bit of a horrendous campaign, I would say, in general. Again, I would agree with Kat, very, very close, a little bit too close for liking a nice 52-48, you know, how we like a 52-48 turnout in the end. But yeah, a little bit too close for comfort, and basically just really relieved so we can now move forward and focus on what I personally think really matters, you know, because everything that's been happening during this campaign has just been, I'm sure we'll go into it in more detail, which is mental. And I think it's nice just to be like, okay, now we can get back to business and focus on what actually matters, and instead of, you know, targeting minorities, you know, basically.
I think, I mean, it was described quite a lot as a continuity candidate, which that seemed to be getting used as a disparaging thing, but considering how popular Nicola Sturgeon was and how successful she was at multiple elections, I don't see how being the continuity candidate was a bad thing in this instance. I'm relieved now in the end. I thought it would be more comfortable than it turned out to be. And with it being dramatic, it felt as if it was like what the battle for the soul of the SNP, for the wider Yes movement, and even for Scotland generally. You know, we always kind of like to portray ourselves as like forward, you know, left of centre, inclusive country. But there is another Scotland that kind of lurks under the surface there. And, you know, I think a lot of that came out when Kate Forbes came out with some very reactionary views, and people who like to say that they're progressive seem to be able to accommodate those reactionary views and still support her. So it's a bit, like you said, it's a relief. I think if either of the other candidates had won, there would be a lot more what-ifs and a lot more uncertainty going forward. Right now, I don't see any big policy switches and what was happening before for the SNP. And I think the only what-if is, you know, can Humza Yousaf grow into the role and, you know, fill the shoes of Nicola Sturgeon, which is no easy task.
I didn't think it would be a runaway win. So it was as close as I feared it would be, if that makes sense. But if I could lift your spirits a little bit, the largest number, if you break down the ballots of like preference combinations, Humza Yousaf only had the highest number. It was almost 10,000. So it was 9,763. And which was far and away more than Kate Forbes' preferences. I'm sorry, there wasn't that many Forbes only, and she did 3-1 beat him in Ash Regan's second preferences, but it wasn't enough. So
were you surprised that it came down to second preferences, did you think?
I was worried that if it did come to second preferences that Kate would win. And I think my take on Ash's face was that I think she thought that she would deliver victory for Kate and have an elevated position in the government, and knew that it wasn't getting across. Like, yeah. So I can't be sad with how it broke down, but I can be sad that that many people were comfortable not worrying about LGBT rights, buffer zones, all that kind of thing. There was plenty of people willing to take Kate's convenient excuses, like I said last week, to make themselves feel better.
Yeah, I think the kind of perceived wisdom was that, you know, either Humza would win it in the first preferences, or Kate might nick it if it came down to the second preferences. But having been in multiple STV votes for council elections over the years, you can never predict what voters are going to do with their preferences. You know, everybody, you know, thought that we're talking like all of Ash Regan's second preferences were going to go to Kate Forbes, and it never works out like that. You know, there's so many, you know, varied reasons why people vote, and you know, some of them for very, very personal and esoteric reasons. So the fact that a quarter of them, the Regan voters, switched to Humza, doesn't make a lot of logical sense when you look at their policy positions. But like I said, voters don't always make sense. And I've seen too many people voting like SNP 1, UKIP 2, or UKIP 1, Scottish Socialist Party 2. There's a lot of people out there that I don't really know how they think about politics or what their reasoning is. And I'm very glad to say that in this case, this seems to have been the difference and led to the more progressive candidate winning.
Yeah, I think what that second preference from Ash Regan maybe comes down to is perhaps not liking the way that Kate Forbes had attacked Humza Yousaf in terms of his position in government. Obviously, at some point, every single one of these candidates had been in Nicola Sturgeon's government. And I think Kate actually lost quite a lot of credibility when she did basically start going after Humza really aggressively. I think it was the first TV debate, wasn't it? Where, I think she was trying to, backpedal a little bit and make it lighthearted, but actually made it worse by saying, oh yeah, I would have you in my cabinet, but definitely not health. And I think what she was doing was basically tarnishing the government, which she, not only was she a part of, but had actually been relatively successful in every single election campaign, not only the Scottish elections, which we just had, 2 years ago. So I think that definitely might have played something into it with these second votes actually going from Ash Regan to Humza Yousaf. But on a more kind of positive note as well, I was really glad to see in the Daily Record today on the front page of Humza saying that, wealth tax the rich, all these types of things. I'm really, really hopeful that this will lead to some even more progressive taxation, because I think the SNP, the Scottish Government in general, is quite easy to pat themselves on the back and say, oh, we've got the most progressive taxation in the whole of the UK. But actually, when you look at the rest of the UK, it's not really that progressive. So I think it would definitely be good to see.
It's a low bar.
It's a very, very low bar. And I think we want to try and avoid where, the Scottish Government does things just a little bit better than the rest of the UK, and then we can, take that as a success. So I'm really was quite happy to see that front page this morning. So not only did the most sort of inclusive candidate win, we've got somebody here who's floating some ideas where, you had Kate Forbes, sort of saying we need small state, we need growth, sending very Liz Trussy. But you've got this from Humza Yousaf on the front page. But I found that quite interesting that was in the front page today, basically when most of the votes probably would have been done. So I think that was actually start of a pitch to beyond the SNP, which I thought was quite smart. And I was definitely very happy to see that this morning. And then ultimately the result at 2 o'clock today.
And also this means that in all, it's almost certain now that the agreement with the Green Party will continue, where it seemed to be very much in danger if either of the other candidates had won.
That and the Greens have all pledged to vote for Humza tomorrow, which will make tomorrow much more boring and much easier on my nerves.
Yes, and they've unanimously agreed as well that the Bute House agreement will continue. So, continuity will cut it, apparently.
It's a hell of a lot better than anything else we got.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been made for a much more interesting vote tomorrow if, say, Kate Forbes had won, because I don't think the Greens would have voted for her for First Minister, which would have left the SNP short of votes, even ruling out any kind of rebellion, which I don't think would have happened. But they would have needed some other group to abstain or to lend their votes, and that would have made for some interesting viewing, but we won't get that now, I suppose.
I think we want something a little bit more boring for, even just a couple of days, just so we can reset, and then let's start, going for the radical left policies and stirring up the Tories and getting them really angry. That could be next week. Let's just have a couple of days of relaxation and reflection.
Yes, and can we also note that both the other candidates have congratulated and accepted the results, which, you know, we didn't really have to, I didn't think we'd have to point that out here, but here we are.
That's a very good point.
It's a really, really good point because, you know, considering where we were, you know, just what, 8 or 9 days ago with this, you know, let's restart the campaign again. Let's, you know, all these other various wild accusations flying around. No, you're right. I think this is where when I tweeted earlier that it's like the whole campaign has not been a good look for, particularly for the SNP, Scottish politics more widely. And it's the fact that we have to point these things out that, yay, the other two candidates actually accepted the result so we can move on from the, you know, the campaign. It's just, it's quite a sad reflection of kind of where we're at, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there's still the lunatic fringe on Twitter that is shouting about that kind of stuff. But it would be nice if that's where that sort of thing stayed rather than having leadership candidates validating it and pushing that narrative in a kind of very Trumpian style.
Agreed.
Well, any other final points on that before we move on?
No, I'm just happy to bask in the joy today. And next Monday, I'll be back to my doubting, gloomy Debbie Downer self, I suppose.
Yeah, no, I think that's very much where I'm at is I'll take the result. I'm relieved. Let's move on.
I think I know what you would say, Kat, but do you think you can kind of fulfill that sort of figurehead role that Nicola Sturgeon was, or do we need that anymore? It would be better if it was a different kind of leader.
Well, I don't think that he'll be the same, right? I think that I worried when people were saying Mary McCallum would be a great leader. I think that she has a lot of potential to be there someday, but it's not that she's too young or too inexperienced. It's that she's a lot like Nicola. And I think we need, for the next leader to be successful, it can't be someone that's so similar to her, if that makes sense, because we do need something fresh and new. And hey, it's our first minister of color. Let's take a moment to appreciate that he's not a white woman. he's a Pakistani heritage man. So I think that there will be plenty different. It's hard for me to tell what Nicola's like specific politics were because she was the government for so long. But like I've said previously, he's a lot more left than I gave him credit for. And on the CNN International, it mentioned specifically that he wants to get rid of the monarchy. And I kind of cheered just that was in the press.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a bit skeptical sometimes of SNP politicians that like to sound very radical left, but don't always kind of fall through in their rhetoric. I still rather hear that rhetoric than not, to be honest. I think even if a politician's not going to walk the walk, talking it's the next best thing because it gives credence to the ideas and helps build a bit of momentum. I didn't catch all of his speech, but I must admit, I thought it was quite moving, the bit when he was talking about his grandparents and them moving to Scotland, and then it kept cutting to his parents and was like, I could feel myself tearing up a wee bit, and I was just like, what happened to me? Why do I cry so easily now? It's ridiculous.
Parenthood.
It is parenthood. It just destroys you.
No, I think that's a really positive, and it's good that, you know, we can take a point to reflect on the fact that it is our first minister of colour. And, you know, stories like that, I think, is really positive. And I think it actually speaks to a lot of people that's much further beyond the normal political discourse, because it is about, you know, communicating to these minority groups that you are included. We know that in Scotland that a lot more people get the opportunity to vote. And, you know, so these kind of things go hand in hand. It's not just, you know, this is a nice little story, but actually there's policies in place to make this as easy as possible for people to vote. As for what you were saying there about, you know, the SNP candidates with their rhetoric being quite left, and I think sometimes certain groups within the SNP can sort of paint themselves to be that kind of radical, and then, you know, we end up at the budget and we're just like, oh, okay, So maybe not then. But I'm hoping with some of the foundations that Hamza sort of put out, that might be this kind of end to that. I think it would be good to see more of that in the budgets going forward. And I think that they will definitely get the support of the Greens to pass things like that. But, you know, again, me, I'll reserve judgment until we're proposed with the next budget or the next, you know, sort of catalogue of progressive policies, and before we can see the proof in the pudding. And I certainly hope that will be the case.
And I was just going to say, first Celtic supporting First Minister, as far as I know. So.
Oh, hey. Hooray.
First all round.
I do often laugh when I hear, especially people running for leader of the government, when they talk about radicalism. And I, you know, it's SNP radical. It's not necessarily radical to all of our standards, but, you know, radical for the SNP is okay for me. Like, as long as you couch your expectations.
Okay.
It's good.
I think we'll need to move on now because we ran on ridiculous amounts last week, so we don't want to make that mistake. See what happens when Deborah's not here tapping the watch.
It's a very, very good point.
I am no Deborah.
Okay, minimum pricing of alcohol. A new report suggests the introduction of minimum unit pricing in Scotland has led to fewer alcohol-related deaths compared to England. Minimum pricing started in 2018 and put a minimum charge of 50p on each unit of alcohol. The study published in The Lancet estimated that following the strategy, 156 deaths a year were averted. Dr. Grant Wiper, Public Health Intelligence Advisor, said the findings highlight that the largest reductions were found for males and for those living in the 40% most deprived areas, groups of which are known to experience disproportionately high levels of alcohol health harm in Scotland. We know that those living in most socioeconomically deprived areas of Scotland experience alcohol-specific deaths more than five times higher compared to those living in the least deprived areas. The results are therefore very encouraging in addressing this inequality and overall scale of preventable harm. The report acknowledges some limitations to the study, including that there was an impact on hospital capacity and attendance during COVID-19 pandemic, and the Scottish Parliament must now vote before the 1st of May next year on whether to continue the minimum unit policy. Right.
Yeah, so, you know, anything that's about saving lives is positive. I think that's, you know, the first thing to be said on that. I think it was pretty conclusive. The research that was done, the findings were quite compelling. And this comes off the back of some earlier reports that were not quite as compelling in their outcomes. It was all very much like it could be working, we're not sure. So this is the first sort of one that I've seen anyway that has been a little bit more positive. I think for me, minimum unit pricing was a positive thing in some aspects. So you've got targeting like really high, like basically really strong, cheaper accessible drinks. So this is like the ciders, the 2 liter bottles of, you know, Jack White and whatever it was. I think that was like one of the main things that it was targeting. Which, you know, was particularly problematic. But I think for me personally, I think there's other avenues that could have been explored perhaps even first before unit pricing. So you've got regulations in terms of alcohol advertising, which is currently going through consultation. You know, because I always try and view alcohol regulation in the same way as that we now see tobacco regulation, right? Because it's the same arguments that we've seen, you know, 30, 40 years ago from the tobacco industry. So, you know, the huge lobby and whatever that's pushing against the current consultation for alcohol advertising. So it's, for me, I think it would have been better if it was part of a suite of policies rather than, okay, we're going to do this particular one and we're going to push forward with it and then we'll, you know, vote on it on a, you know, a couple of years basis to see if we can continue it. It's almost like it should have been part of a wider, more joined up policy, because alcohol consumption, particularly in the UK and in Scotland, is extremely problematic. So I think that we should be looking to a much wider suite of policies to to help with that. And then, you know, within that, you've got support when it comes to addiction, not just for alcohol, but for wider issues. So it seems, and it's what the Scottish government can sometimes be criticised for, is, okay, we've got this big, huge problem, so we're just going to use this one thing to fix it, rather than thinking more broadly, more joined up, and actually communicating clearly what the issues are and why we want to try and prevent these harms from being inflicted on society.
I don't disagree with anything that you've been saying, Brian. Funnily enough, Wisconsin, where I grew up, is one of the highest binge drinking states in the US, but it's because of older people who knock back quite a few after a day of work. So it's not the binge drinking partying that you'd think of. I totally think what you're saying about advertising around alcohol is different. You know, that will be a game changer, but it's about the culture, right? It's about what the culture thinks is acceptable. So minimum pricing is not definitely the most popular way to do it. I think a lot of people have been angry about that. But it's done good. It's done more good than harm. And I hope that we continue the work, the Greens and the SNP, on doing that. And I'm sure there's other politicians and other parties that also support it. I just don't know specifically. I kind of said before we started recording that this leads me into my thoughts on the medical use of cannabis and the legalization of that, or using psychedelics to treat mental health issues and addictions, and you know, safe injection sites and all these things that I think alcohol is a drug. So why is this so widely available when it causes so much more harm than these other things that can actually be used? I think that we need to have a radically different approach to drugs and alcohol. Well, alcohol as a drug. But I think we're on the right track with that in Scotland. And I think that is something that's kind of cross-party for the most part, maybe not the Tories.
I mean, partly the reason I wanted to talk about this is because I remembered I was working in an alcohol rehabilitation unit when the minimum pricing was kind of going through Parliament. And it reminds me a lot, the opposition to it reminds me a lot of some of the stuff around the bottle deposit scheme at the moment, where it's like, you know, even if the minimum pricing didn't work, it wasn't going to cause chaos. It was making some drinks a lot dearer. They were the sort of drinks that really shouldn't even exist. They were like super strong ciders that the drinks companies were only really producing that because they knew that's what chronic alcoholics bought a lot of. That was the only reason. Nobody was sipping a 3-liter bottle of Frosty Jack if they didn't already have a bit of an alcohol problem in some way. But the sort of opposition that keeps cropping up to the Scottish government amongst the other parties, where they turn the most banal issues into like almost culture war sort of level debates, where it's like as if the stakes are so high and it'll be the end of the world if something passes. So it's nice to see that something that was argued that way, you know, a few years ago, or it turns out actually it saved, you know, 156 deaths every year. So that's literally hundreds of people who have been saved because of that. And this is also why I've always had a bit of a soft spot for Willie Rennie, because he came to visit my work when this was going on, when he just became Lib Dem leader, and he changed the Lib Dems' position on this, because previously all the unionist parties had just lined up in complete opposition to it, and he sort of broke the united opposition to that, which might have been instrumental in going through. So I'm glad it came in. I really hope they continue. It seems as if there's evidence to keep it going, and hopefully the likes of the Tories and the more reactionary parts of Scottish Labour don't decide to try and turn this into yet another totemic issue against the evil gnats in the Scottish government. Because as we see, it's actually, there's people's lives are at stake.
Yeah, And when you zoom out from this as well, where you look at the Tories and they're like, oh, you know, this is ridiculous. It's the nanny state, you know, all this usual jargon. And then you flip over to, you know, what's happening in Westminster and we want to ban laughing gas, you know. So it's you know, because that's linked to really bad antisocial behaviour. So it's, you know, the Tories are just being the Tories. And this is, you know, this is a much wider point that I think for me that Scottish politics would be much, much better if we didn't have the Tories as an opposition party, because it's almost like watching two separate channels, isn't it? You've got, like, you know, the Tories saying X, Y, and Z in the Scottish Parliament, then you flip over to Westminster and, you know, they're arguing for similar things. So it's just ridiculous and unhelpful and opportunistic, right? So yeah, it's like when you're talking about all these things with people who are likely to have some sort of dependency on alcohol, reaching for these, you know, really extra strength ciders and the Jack Whites that I was talking about earlier, that this is obviously what it was there to target for. And it's good to see, like, because I think Willie Rennie was quite constructive during these debates. He wasn't very much, like, you know, kind of buying into the hysteria. So I'm sure it will be continued, because that's, you know, some strong evidence to support it. I'm sure the Greens will support it, and I'm sure the Lib Dems themselves will obviously support the extension of it, whether the other two parties, you know, whatever they decide to do. But I just hope that with the outcome of the Scottish leadership election, that we will see the continuation of at least the consultation for alcohol advertising, because I think that this could start to be the change of a culture of where we actually start to treat alcohol as the drug that it is, that can cause a lot of harm, and not just use it as some sort of luxury product that's, you know, sort of slapped onto everywhere that's accessible to everyone. So it would be good to see alcohol sort of almost the way we treat tobacco now, as that it's, you know, it's available, you can go to shops, you can buy it, but it's not glamorized, it's not used, like I said, as a sort of luxury product, and is it harmful, and it should be regulated.
This is where the continuity does cut it, because there are so many important things going on right now, both legislatively and just consultation wise, that could have been scrapped completely, especially if the Greens weren't in government, because how do you put forward a bill where the party you were putting it forward with and writing it with are now in opposition? So I think that this is also a good sign that, like, the progress we've made with unionist parties and politicians to gather support for things that are for the greater good is really important. So sometimes this deadlock with Westminster, it's not democratic. I don't like it, but there is progress happening despite it. And I don't think people notice it as much. But if you take independence out of it, there are less unionist parties just completely opposing everything put forward, because it would look really bad on their parts. And, you know, and I guess I'm just a ray of sunshine today.
Yeah. And it's true. Like, if you look at, you know, looking at the universal access to period products and things like that. So it's like, you know, proposed by Monica Lennon, it was adopted, and there was a lot of, you know, at one point, you know, there was the sort of opposition game being played at one point. And then there was, you know, because of the pushback of essentially SNP members, you know, pressure groups campaigning, that actually it was like, you know, let's take the heat out of it and actually let's make the right decision here. And ultimately it passed. And it was good to see that with, you know, parties like the Greens, the SNP, Labour, I believe the Lib Dems as well, you know, all coming together to pass something that's so positive, you know. So it's true that you do actually notice a lot more, that we've kind of moved away from where we were maybe, you know, before COVID, even certainly maybe 2017, where, you know, Labour wouldn't even be involved in budget debates, because it was like, we will not, you know, take part of this debate unless the SNP drops their demand for independence referendum or whatever. And we have sort of moved beyond that, and that's definitely positive, and it does make better legislation.
Yeah, I think Labour in the Scottish Parliament have got a big role in that, because I think the expectations of the Tories are fairly low, that they are just going to be, like, you know, opposing everything and, you know, playing to the gallery. And I think over the years, Labour have been too guilty of kind of mimicking the Tories in that sense, rather than being the more constructive centre-left opposition that they claim to be. And I think if there is more of that, it can only be a good thing for Scottish politics.
Agreed.
Any final thoughts before we move on? And now a word from our sponsor. Our sponsor this week is Sense of Nature Pet Service, based in central Scotland. Sense of Nature gives you a hands-on, personalised experience with a variety of exciting creatures. From snakes and skunks to tarantulas and turtles, Sense of Nature has something for everyone. They offer sensory sessions, one-to-one and group sessions, educational encounters for children of all ages, and they are available for private events upon inquiry. Animal welfare is at the forefront of everything they do, and if appropriate, a risk assessment can be carried out at no additional cost prior to your booking. To get 5% off your next booking with Sense of Nature, quote Holyrood Ungagged 5 at time of booking. To contact Sense of Nature, you can do so by email on sense.of.natureinquiries@outlook.com. You can also find them on most social media platforms by searching for Sense of Nature. Boris Johnson. I've not mentioned that name in a while. Boris Johnson stood before the Privilege Committee last week to state his case when it comes to the Partygate scandal and whether he committed contempt of Parliament or not. During the televised inquiry, the former Prime Minister stated why he believed he did not mislead Parliament, branding the allegations as complete nonsense. He declared, "What I can tell the Right Honourable and Learned Gentleman is that all guidance was followed completely in Number 10. As it stands, no official verdict on his actions has been made following the public hearing Mr. Johnson's written submission. The committee will now begin to complete the investigation, which began in June 2022. Once the committee has concluded its investigation, it will decide whether it believes that Uxbridge MP misled Parliament and whether this is contempt. If they believe he did, they will also recommend a sanction for his actions. They will issue a full report on the findings, and a recommendation will be delivered to the House of Commons, where all MPs will then vote on whether they agree or disagree." Rishi Sunak has declared that this will be a free vote, meaning Conservative MPs can vote however they wish. Did anybody catch the appearance by Boris at the committee?
I've seen some highlights, which seems to be the the sort of main talking points or the anchor points, where basically he was just acting like a spoiled brat who was being challenged for once in his life. Essentially,
I saw the same. I didn't see the whole thing. My political universe is centered around Holyrood, but I did see a lot of shots of his lawyer getting visibly frustrated with him. I did think when I was watching the clips of it, of like this is why they didn't let Trump testify in front of Congress, because it would have been worse, but still visibly bad. One thing I did hear catch somewhere in the commentary is that any possibility of him staging a comeback is now dead in the water, which makes me happy.
Well, you would hope so, but until the result comes back, and I mean, I don't think it's even guaranteed that MPs will vote to implement the recommendations of the committee. So I think we're still quite a while for that. I mean, he just lied through his teeth, didn't he? I mean, we all know what happened with Partygate. You know, to sit there and pretend that all the rules were followed, when we've all seen the pictures, he was standing in amongst a crowd, everybody glass in hand, birthday cake on the table, and it's like, you'd think he'd try to come up with an explanation rather than just sitting there barefaced lying about, oh, I didn't know the rules. I thought the rules were this. And even if the rules were that, I didn't do that anyway. And, you know, it's pathetic. He is like a kid sort of stamping his feet and refusing to go to bed. Because it's time to go to bed. You're finished. Or hopefully you're finished. But even if the report comes back, and I think the committee will probably recommend quite heavy sanctions. I'm not convinced the Tory backbenchers will rally behind them, despite everything.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what you're saying here, and I think the committee will have quite heavy recommendations, but then it will come down to the parliamentary vote. But I think this is just a bit of a sad reflection of Westminster politics and the two-party system. I think it's probably the most important point of this. But I think it's so easy to get to a position where, because see, when it comes to the real, you know, detail of what happened, who said what, who was where, what were these pictures for, you know, I didn't believe it was breaking the rules, I was told it didn't, blah blah blah, it could become really monotonous and tiring and people just disengage with it. But obviously that's part of the plan, and I believe to make it, you know, to try and exclude as many people as possible to be critical and critically engage with it. But there was a story, I can't remember like what radio station it was on, I believe it was LBC, and it was somebody who was from the north of England, and basically he was putting his point of view across of, you know, he had had to attend his son's funeral during this time. It was the same day as one of these parties, and I think when it really comes down to like the real people's stories of what was happening during this time, and because it's so easy to forget because we just want to move on from COVID. It was a difficult time for so many people, obviously much more challenging for others than certain people. But it's like when you hear stories like that, it does actually remind you of just how important this is. And I think it's really important for these people to be held accountable, and I really hope that what the recommendations are of the committee, I do hope that the Parliament upholds that decision, and I hope we start to see a recall petition and a by-election in Uxbridge and South Ruislip, because I do believe he will lose it. Even Nadine Dorris herself and her fantastic talk TV show that seems to just go viral every time there's an episode, herself has basically said, you know, it's a stitch up, but you know, if there's a by-election, Boris Johnson's political career is over. So the cat's out of the bag. That, you know, even she, the most ardent Boris Johnson supporter, believes that his political career is over if there's a by-election. And you know, like the famous GIF says, I would like to see it.
Yeah, that is the way he actually finish him, which I think is no easy if because you know, he's so utterly shameless that, you know, he'll always be willing to make a comeback or think he's got a chance to make a comeback. If they recommend that he's suspended and at least a recall petition, I think you're right. I think he'll lose that by-election. And then all the Tory MPs that, they all know what kind of man he is. They don't, the ones that support him, they don't support him because they admire his integrity or his honesty. They still believe he's got a kind of cachet with the public and that he's got that kind of celebrity that a lot of other MPs don't have. And they think that might be enough to help them save their seat. But if he loses his seat in a by-election, then he's a loser. And they know that the public don't support him anymore and are done with his bullshit. And then there's no reason for them to rally around and support him, because the only reason to do that is if they think he's still a winner, and that'll prove he's not, and he'll be done. If that doesn't happen, I think there is a good chance that the Tories go into the next election, have a catastrophic result. That'll finish off Sunak, and it'll be a small pool to pick the next leader, and I think Boris will be the only one willing to take it on, and he'd be back. And I could see him being quite an effective leader of the opposition. I think he's a terrible prime minister, but he can get sound bites. He can, you know, play to the gallery. I think that might go quite well against a very dour Keir Starmer-led Labour government. And I think that's what he probably sees as his route back to power. And I hope it never happens. But at the moment, that route is still open to him, I think.
I think, like you were saying there, that he actually potentially could be, for certain audiences around the UK, could be quite an effective opposition. And I just hope that he's not given that opportunity. I think that if the way that this should go should definitely be to, you know, sanctions, to recall petition, to by-election. And I think, well, the tide is very much against the Tories at the moment, particularly in Poland, across the whole UK, that, you know, this could be the one that would actually, he would lose that by-election. And I think it would be a win for Labour in that seat. And I think that that message would actually be quite a strong one for the next general election. You know, seeing Boris, the back of Boris Johnson, which again would be another sigh of relief from me in general. So, you know, if that's going to be forthcoming, I'll absolutely take it.
We'll move on to the final topic now. Jeremy Corbyn will not stand as a Labour MP at the next election. Keir Starmer will confirm at Tuesday's National Executive Committee meeting that he vowed to prove the party had changed under his leadership. He will propose a motion that makes it clear that the party's ruling body will not endorse Jeremy Corbyn as a Labour candidate for the next Westminster election. This comes after a speech during the week where he quoted Margaret Thatcher and launched into a very bizarre anecdote about people's lives being destroyed because they can smell cannabis from their bedroom window. And it was just a general sort of, you know, tough on crime speech, a very stereotypical sort of speech pandering to the right wing as usual. And it just leads to more pessimism and depression surrounding the supposed Labour Party in the UK. Brian, any comments?
Oof, plenty on this one. You know, taking Starmer, first of all, on this sort of hard approach to crime, sort of approach, the speech, the quoting Margaret Thatcher, that she was right, that, you know, crime was one of the most important issues. And you've got, you know, this really sort of nameless anecdote of, you know, somebody who, in Holborn, which is Starmer's constituency, that they can smell cannabis. I think I believe it was in the child's bedroom, stuff like that, right? Which, you know, I get it, right? Why don't you just have a chat with your neighbour and ask them not to smoke underneath your child's bedroom? Like, this is an issue that really should be referred to.
Or shut the window.
Exactly. So this is a bit like, you know, what can you do to avoid this from happening? You know, the highest this should ever get to is like councillor level. You know, like, we shouldn't be, like, Starmer shouldn't be, you know, quoting this in a speech about the next, what the next UK Labour government is going to do on crime. And what this is really starting to show is it's starting to, and the Tories are as bad as this, because you're talking about antisocial behaviour and whatnot at all. So it's basically going right the way down to these issues which are, you know, could be deemed as less important to certain people, or, you know, not headline issues that we should be talking about, especially when we're living in a country where people are having to access, you know, warm banks, food banks are spiraling. You know, you've got massive inequality, you've got, you know, people can't afford to pay their heating, yet we're talking about somebody smelling hash in their house. I mean is this really what the most important thing is? I think the news about Jeremy Corbyn, I think, is sad. I think that Westminster politics, UK politics, would be better if Jeremy Corbyn was part of that and part of the debate in Westminster. I think he's one of the few people on the opposition benches that genuinely speaks from passion when it comes to inclusion, when it comes to rights, human rights of people, and particularly on issues where a lot of people want to stand back and not be part of, whether that be the Israeli state, which obviously is named by Amnesty International as an apartheid state. And he speaks about these issues through that prism, which a lot of MPs tend to just sort of stand back and not want to get involved in any controversy that might surround it. I think it's absolutely staggering that it's a proposal that's going to the NEC from Keir Starmer himself to block Corbyn standing as a UK Labour Party politician for the next general election. In the actual motion itself, it doesn't even mention the issues around anti-Semitism, which is how he has been portrayed to be excluded from the Labour PLP. It's so complex to, you know, there's so many different steps to this. It's just weird. But, you know, because he is a member of the Labour Party, he is an MP that was elected as a Labour MP, but he's not in the Labour Parliamentary Party. So it's all very, very, very strange. But you've got this motion that's going to the NEC to say, you know, this person's not allowed to stand as a Labour MP because he lost so badly as the leader of the Labour Party. This is basically what this motion says. Yet you've got Ed Miliband, who basically wiped out all, pretty much all the MPs in Scotland, is now in the shadow cabinet. So it's the most, basically what Keir Starmer's doing is playing to the gallery. You know, we're a new Labour Party, we've moved on, and Corbyn, you know, being excluded is some sort of ice and cherry on top for them to say to the moderates or centrists or whatever you want to call them, we're the good Labour Party that you can trust again. And to me, it's just really, really sad. I hope Jeremy Corbyn stands, whether that be as a Labour MP or as an independent MP in Islington North, and I hope that he is elected by his constituents, because across the board, everyone says he's a good constituency MP, and he's really, really popular. I think it's 1983 the MP from. So, I just hope that this is... I hope there's a happy ending for this for the constituents of Islington North and for Jeremy Corbyn.
I think both of these things from UK Labour, from Keir Starmer, are how to get grandma and grandpa's vote, right? You know, Jeremy Corbyn, oh, he's far too much to the left, and that's how you win back the more conservative Labour voters. And the antisocial behaviour is just a great way to get people, older people. You can scare them and whip up some fear. Not older, that's not fair to just say older people, but there's a certain amount of the population that are very reactive to fear and fear-based things, like, what if you smelled hash and your baby could breathe it in? And without, most people would go, why don't you close a window or have a chat with your neighbor, like you said. It's a very top-down approach for a party that's supposed to be for the people, isn't it?
Well, there you go, eh?
Yeah, I mean, it's really sad. Like, you know, the sort of persecution of Jeremy Corbyn, it's not like a factional fight, because Corbyn doesn't seem as if he's trying to rally and undermine Keir Starmer, so it just seems like he's punching somebody who's not really trying to pick a fight with him. Even though most Corbyn supporters, I think, would feel Corbyn would be very rightly within his rights to go after Starmer. Corbyn never particularly wanted to be Labour leader, I don't think. It was a crazy set of events that put him in that position. You know, I always think, you know, sometimes the best leaders might be the ones that don't seek it. I think... is quite happy to go back to just being the best constituency MP he can be, and that voice of the left on particular issues that get neglected. And it's kind of sad that they'll no let him just go back to doing that. You know, he was an MP for 40 years serving that constituency, and God knows how many more years he was a member of the Labour Party. And now he's in this situation that either he has to give up being an MP, or he stands as an independent, in which case he is automatically expelled from the Labour Party. So I think Starmer's looking at this as win-win. Either Corbyn, you know, expels himself from the Labour Party, or he gets him out of Parliament. Personally, I think Corbyn will win if he stands. I think if Corbyn was more vindictive, they would run his son next door against Keir Starmer, which could cost him his seat, and I think that would be delicious.
That'd be great.
But again, I don't actually see Corbyn doing something as vindictive as that, which may be a huge fault in why the Corbyn Labour Party wasn't successful. But again, though, I think it speaks that he's a decent person and doesn't deserve the kind of horrific treatment he's getting. going back to Starmer, it's like you can tell he's taking advice from Peter Mandelson, because every single thing is like a warmed up rehash of Tony Blair and Gordon Brown in the late 90s, 2000s, even quoting Thatcher. That's just a rehash of Gordon Brown inviting Thatcher into number 10 for tea. Only obviously Keir Starmer can't do that because Thatcher's dead. So they had to do the next best thing and just quote her in a speech. And it's like the persecution of Jeremy Corbyn is kind of like the union bashing that Tony Blair kind of did when he first came in. And it's a sort of parallel for that. It's like the more Starmer stamps on Corbyn and Corbyn supporters, it's like he's trying to prove to the right-wing newspapers that will probably never really support him anyway, that, oh, please let me win. Let me win. Let me have some power. And it just shows you who's really in charge of the UK, and it's not really our political leaders. Kind of went on a tangent there.
You did, and you had a lot to say, and you said it, and it was beautiful. The another thing when it comes to this attack on the left with some of the left MPs that still exist within the Labour Parliamentary Party is that what they're hoping is that people like Diane Abbott and other left Labour MPs perhaps will break ranks and be supportive of Corbyn, whether it be an independent MP or part of another bloc. So this peace and justice campaign that Corbyn is part of, and therefore perhaps it's an opportunity to exclude more left Labour MPs. And ultimately, it's just incredibly sad to see how it's come out. And you're talking about, you know, if Corbyn was a little bit more vindictive and a bit more forthright of taking on the more centrist right wing Labour MPs, it would just be really good to see that, because you've got other examples of this top down thing that kind of picked up on is that, well, during the Starmer's leadership campaign, he was like, you know, it should be for local parties to, you know, choose their candidates and all this kind of stuff. And I think it was just last week that Labour unanimously, the NEC or the Central Party, basically blocked 40% of councillors standing in Leicester as well. A lot of them were councillors of colour, mostly of the left as well. And this is just a very top-down example of that. And now we're seeing it with Corbyn. And it just kind of comes full circle back around to, you know, the SNP leadership, where you've got people like, you know, within the Labour Party, you know, Jackie Bailey saying, you know, the SNP's tearing themselves to shreds and, you know, it's, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And then you've actually got the NEC and the powers that be within the Labour Party saying, you know, 40% of those councillors are not allowed to stand. You know, let's take Corbyn out so he's not going to stand here, and basically trying to make it a centralised strategy. It's just hypocrisy at its worst. And, you know, people can see what's going on. We're not stupid.
Particularly off it, it was a week ago, we just kept hearing from opposition politicians in Scotland about it was terrible. All the divisions in the SNP were caused by Nicola Sturgeon centralising power too much. And then you look at what Starmer's doing. Starmer's like actually intervening and handpicking individual candidates and constituencies. And I mean, could you imagine if Jeremy Corbyn excluded like 19 councillors in the one city, the vast majority of whom are ethnic minority? I mean, they called him Stalinist because he had a reshuffle and decided to like change up some of the people in his cabinet.
Yeah.
Yet apparently Starmer can expel who he wants. And, you know, for some reason, these kind of criticisms never get brought up or used against them.
Because he's a middle-class white man, David. He's a KC or whatever they're called.
I kind of get used to the fact that they're called KCs rather than QCs. And every time I see it, I pause and I hesitate and think, oh, what does that mean?
I still call them QCs in my head because KC is, those are my initials. So I don't like that.
You could just start putting that at the end of your name and just let people think you're a lawyer.
Nah, I'm good without. I've never been the type to artificially inflate my own experience. But I would like to put in a request that we get a lot more Keir Starmer impressions from Brian, because I thought that was brilliant.
Well, I think that perhaps we should put this forward as something that we could include in the podcast going forward.
Yeah. I mean, he doesn't seem like a man who has good taste in any way, so why would you want him to handpick anything?
Yeah, he's like the sort of human version of
Big Potato Face.
Potato Face, you call him Potato Face.
That was Deborah, I think, that came up with that.
It was Deborah. But do you know, there's like, what's the most uninspiring thing that's just there? Like, that's what, to me, Keir Starmer's Labour Party is.
Spam. But spam has more function than Keir Starmer, I think.
Yeah. I just think it's, you know, just like, it's like the boring option. It's like, it's there. And, you know, polls are looking like they're going to win next time, yet it's like I'm not enthusiastic about it. Like, of course, great to see the back of the Tories, but then it's just a bit like, oh great, so now we have to start making a progressive case and fighting this party as opposed to that party. It's just exhausting, you know.
There is a dark, twisty part of my psyche that would love to see the Tories win that election, just to see Starmer's face as it dawns on him that he's betrayed everything that he supposedly believes in. You know, all the horrible wee shabby deals and petty acts that he's done in order to get power, and to find it all just for nothing. I'd love to see that.
My favourite outcome of the next general election would be that there is a hung parliament and it's Labour is just ahead of the Tories, and the SNP have got enough numbers to make up to a majority, and I think that this would be the best situation that could happen. That's what I was hoping for in a Corbyn government, actually. And I think it would have been, because ultimately, you know, the Scottish Parliament will get what, you know, what the majority of it is voting for, is to say, you know, we need another independence referendum that's legal, and you need to give it to us, or, you know, or you can't pass a budget. So I think that that's definitely, that would be a positive outcome. The polls are very narrowly closing as well. You know, at one point Labour was like, you know, 20, 25 points ahead, and it's slowly, slowly, slowly getting more narrower. And a campaign hasn't even started yet. We don't know when the next general election is going to be. You know, and if we're talking about the smell of hash and a close or whatever, then if this is really the most inspiring thing we can talk about, when you're mass inequality, you know, groups lobbying against the human rights of our trans, non-binary, genderqueer siblings, and you know, people can't afford to put the heating on, and this is like the most inspirational thing that we can talk about. It's just depressing, and ultimately it's going to end up in a and Starmer not getting a majority.
I would like to see that scenario, but with the added caveat of Starmer actually loses his seat as well in the process
to Tommy Corbyn.
Well, even if Tommy Corbyn doesn't actually win, but if he just costs him enough votes,
yeah,
which I think is actually possible, that would be so funny to see Starmer standing there like Michael Bertello in 1997,
like just humiliated.
Ghost Vinson in 2019,
yeah,
and then Jeremy Corbyn was sworn into the count to congratulate his son and standing. That would just be I would stay up to watch that.
Yeah, I think it would be a lovely end to that. And I think also as well to see, you know, Caroline Lucas having some influence over government policy when it comes to the Green New Deal, I think would be a positive thing also. So, you know, there's loads of potentially progressive and popular outcomes to this general election. But yeah, Keir Starmer's just not the one, is it?
But again, we've been over this a lot, but with the Westminster voting system, you know, even if the Greens in England and Wales have, you know, like their absolute dream scenario in terms of results, they're still only likely to have 3 or 4 seats, which even in the tightest of parliaments is unlikely to make a difference.
It's very true. Very, very true. And then, you know, perhaps it's just you know, if Keir Starmer is listening to my fantastic impressions, you know, just if you start even just floating the ideas like PR and things like that, that you might actually get a progressive group of people that will say, do you know what, we'll vote for him so we can get PR and then we can go elsewhere. But you know, now I'm just reaching for the stars and putting a nice wish list out there. But you know, gotta be hopeful.
Never stop dreaming, Brian. Never stop dreaming.
I mean, after the result we've had today, I mean, who couldn't?
I mean, with a Keir Starmer Labour, it's supposed to be pragmatism as an ideology again. So anything where they would have to rely on the SNP for votes would be great for me, because he would. I think that would turn Labour away from being as unionist as trying to out-unionist the Tories, if that's. Or we might see that their pragmatism is more bullshit than yeah, reality.
Personally, I think even in that dream scenario, the numbers where the SNP have the balance of power, I think Labour are so spineless that they would go against their own party interests to worship to the British state and the right-wing press. I honestly don't think Starmer would love to have that centrist moment of feeling like he's fallen in his sword and sacrificing his own career to save Britain.
I mean, more and more workers' unions are disaffiliating with Labour as, you know, as we speak. So that's probably also a good, I mean, the best thing would be if Labour really was for the workers. But I think trade unions aren't affiliated with political parties in America. So I find that difficult sometimes to wrap my head around. So I kind of enjoy where they'll work with different parties like the Greens, the SNP. Others that I don't know their names.
Yeah, it is interesting, but ultimately, it's weird because the Labour particular history was involving out of the trade unions, and now the trade union movement sort of like and cutting them off. I mean, it's fascinating, you know, seeing like Sharon Graham of Unite, which is, you know, ultimately one of the biggest funders of Labour, has basically been like, if you continue this, we'll have a vote. And I don't think you'll like the outcome. So, yeah, it's interesting times ahead for UK Labour.
I'm sensing we're on the edge of a rabbit hole here, so going to draw an end to this before we end up stuck here for another 40 minutes. Kat, Brian, thanks for joining me. Everybody that's listening, thanks for downloading or, I was going to say, tuning in. You don't really tune into a podcast. But if you like the podcast, you can find our previous episodes at leftungagged.org, as well as written articles, and you can sign up for our free newsletter. If you liked what Kat had to say, you can catch up with her and our co-host Erin on the Talking Sense podcast. And if you've got anything you want us to talk about, you can tweet us at _ungagged, #HollywoodUngagged, or drop us an email at ungaggedleft@gmail.com and put HollywoodUngagged in the subject line. And if you enjoyed this episode, please give us 5 stars on whatever podcast platform you use. And if you'd like to join our Discord community, please get in touch through any of our social media platforms and we can add you to that. But until then, have fun, be good, and be lucky.
I have something to plug in a wee announcement that the 4th confirmed speaker for the Rally for a Republic, Not Our King, on Coronation Day, May 6th, is David McClement. So we're very excited to welcome David to the group of speakers that includes Tommy Shepherd, Maggie Chapman, and Ross McKenzie so far, with more to be announced soon. That will be at Calton Hill in Edinburgh. Our rally is an anti-monarchy peaceful protest with wonderful speakers at Calton Hill at 3 p.m.
Yes, there's no drop out now.
Yeah, that's it. It's out in the world now.
Okay, so now we're definitely done.
Thank you. Bye.